From ABC News, this is Perspective. I'm Derek Dennis. Coming up, Arizona on track to become another state limiting abortion access using a Civil War era law that's been upheld by the state Supreme Court. Patients and doctors left in limbo.
Obstetrician gynecology residents won't want to come to Arizona to train in this if they can't get the full scope of the care that they need to be able to provide for patients.
The impending law already impacting the medical community and the women seeking the procedure. Weeks after the deadly collapse of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, the Port of Baltimore is only barely back in business.
It's the fear of the unknown. We don't know how long are they going to be off. How long is it going to take them to open the channel?
How longshoremen are getting goods in and out, and the aggressive timeline to reopen the port fully. And the king of the horror genre, celebrating 50 years since his first novel. Stephen King, the frightening force whose storytelling scared us all out of our minds. All ahead on Perspective. Abraham Lincoln was president, and slavery hadn't officially ended yet. In 1864, Arizona enacted a law that criminalized abortions. And now, some 160 years later, the Arizona Supreme Court has upheld the law, making abortions illegal and allowing doctors to face prosecution. Democrats are outraged by the ruling, including Arizona's Governor Katie Hobbs. Republicans have been walking a tightrope, with some calling it an overstep. But others in the Republican-controlled Arizona legislature voted to block an effort to repeal the old law. ABC's Rachel Scott takes a look at the measure, the state Supreme Court's ruling, and the political fallout.
The law was written in 1864, before Arizona was even a state, and before women had the right to vote. No exceptions for rape or incest, only to protect the mother's life.
The near total Civil War era ban that continues to hang over our heads only serves to create more chaos for women and doctors in our state.
The ruling by the Arizona court referring 22 times to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe versus Wade. Donald Trump has boasted of appointing three of the six justices who overturned Roe.
The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state.
President Biden calling the ban extreme, dangerous, and cruel. Biden and Trump both know that abortion rights has won in all six states where it has been on the ballot, including in conservative states like Kansas, Kentucky, and Ohio. This November, it could be on the ballot in 14 states, including battleground Arizona. Several Republicans in that state distancing themselves from the ruling. GOP Senate candidate Carrie Lake, who once vocally supported the law, now saying it's out of step with Arizonans. Frustration felt on both sides of the aisle. Arizona Democratic lawmaker Eva Birch recently had an abortion after she learned her pregnancy was non-viable.
Somebody gave me a procedure so that I wouldn't have to experience another miscarriage. The pain, the mess, the discomfort. And now we're talking about whether or not we should put that doctor in jail.
Doctors who perform abortions could face up to 5 years in prison. Dr. Shelley Tien is an OBGYN specializing in high-risk pregnancies in Arizona. She also works as an abortion provider in three states.
These decisions should only be left up to patients and to completely rob patients and families from being able to, you know, make these decisions. It's truly, truly, it's terrible. It's cruel.
ABC's Rachel Scott reporting. The real-world implications of Arizona Supreme Court ruling hitting abortion clinics statewide, especially when it comes to providers. Doctors say they face an uncertain future with a fear of criminal charges if they choose to carry out abortions in the event the health of the mother is at risk. Dr. Jill Gibson, Chief Medical Director for Planned Parenthood Arizona, on What's at Stake with ABC's Lindsay Davis.
We understand you were in clinic with patients as that decision came down. Curious to know what your experience was like as you were talking with those patients.
Yes, it's really been reminiscent of the days in the immediate aftermath of the Dobbs decision when we were first forced to turn away patients at our front window who were here seeking abortion services. I'm having patients calling in asking if our doors are still open, asking if they can still access the health care that we we guaranteed that we would provide for them. Patients are sitting in our waiting room and they're reading the news media. And when they come into my office and I'm explaining to them the abortion procedure, they just have questions about how this could possibly be that legislators and politicians are determining whether or not they can have this healthcare procedure.
When does this abortion ban go into effect?
We're still digesting the recent news, and we're certainly having our legal teams review for all angles. What I can say is that Planned Parenthood is committed to providing abortion in the state of Arizona every last moment that it is legally feasible, and we will continue to keep our doors open for all the other sexual and reproductive health care services that we offer forever.
In your experience, what impact does criminalizing abortion have?
Well, it certainly contributes to the ongoing stigma associated around abortion care. We know that this is essential health care services that should be treated the same way that all other health care services are. But what I can say is from my own personal experience providing in the aftermath of the Dobbs decision is that when you take a safe and effective medical therapy that has been the law of the land and precedented healthcare for over 50 years, and you make it a criminal act, you will absolutely dissuade physicians from wanting to participate in that service. And that will have longstanding repercussions. Obstetrician gynecology residents won't want to come to Arizona to train in this if they can't get the full scope of the care that they need to be able to provide for patients.
How about for you in particular?
I have oaths to my patients that I will uphold. I also have oaths and responsibilities to my family. So I plan to follow the law. But what I can say is that I will absolutely never stop fighting until we can restore the right to bodily autonomy in this state and across our country. I have sat with thousands of women, and I never ask anyone to justify the reason for their abortion. But so many patients tell me why they absolutely need to have an abortion, why they cannot be pregnant. And to restrict patients from exercising that basic human right is absolutely unacceptable, and it's cruel.
Would you describe your reaction?
I'm heartbroken and I'm outraged. This feels a lot like the days after the Dobbs decision. And I have to say that I thought we had moved beyond that. I thought that we know that this is essential healthcare service, and so I feel absolutely heartbroken for the citizens of this state.
It's unclear just how long abortions will be available in the state. How are you advising your patients?
We will be digging through this with a fine-tooth comb. Unfortunately, healthcare is now dictated by legalese, and rather than paying attention to the nuance of actual patients and the decisions that are right for themselves and their families, we have to resort to legal counsel. And so we will be seeking that legal counsel to ensure that we can provide safe and effective healthcare under this new law.
Dr. Jill Gibson of Planned Parenthood Arizona joining ABC's Lindsay Davis. Coming up, a landmark sentencing in Michigan. Two parents getting prison time because their son carried out a mass shooting. The case of the Crumbleys on Perspective. After this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. Prison time for the parents of the Oxford High School shooter in Michigan, Ethan Crumbley. Jennifer and James Crumbley given the maximum sentence allowed, 10 to 15 years each, in what prosecutors said was an extreme case of child neglect and parental failure. Their case, the first time a parent in the U.S. has been held responsible for the actions of their child in a mass shooting. ABC's Trevor Ault on the lesson the Crumbleys indirectly gave to all parents, that exceptionally bad parenting could spell prison.
In a Michigan courtroom, anguished parents speaking directly to the parents of their child's killer.
You failed as parents. The punishment that you face will never be enough. It will never bring her back.
It is devastating and heartbreaking that it doesn't appear that either of you cherished or even wanted your son. But I wholeheartedly wanted and cherished mine.
Jennifer and James Crumbly, the first parents in the nation held criminally responsible for their son Ethan's school shooting, today sentenced by a judge.
These convictions are not about poor parenting. These convictions confirm repeated acts or lack of acts that could have halted an oncoming runaway train.
The Crumblies each receiving 10 to 15 years in prison, the maximum requested by prosecutors and victims' families.
We were good parents. We were the average family. We weren't perfect, but we loved our son and each other tremendously.
And my heart is really broken for everybody involved. I understand my words are not going to bring any comfort.
In two separate trials, first Jennifer, then James, they were found guilty of four counts of involuntary manslaughter, one for each of their son's four shooting victims, Oxford High School students Madison Baldwin, Tate Meir, Hannah St. Juliana, and Justin Schilling. Ethan Crumbly was 15 when he used a gun purchased by his parents to carry out the deadliest school shooting in Michigan's history in 2021.
I am a really bad person. I have done terrible things that no one should ever do.
Ethan later pleaded guilty to killing his four classmates and was sentenced to life without parole. Jennifer's trial began in January, prosecutors ticking through the many opportunities they say she had to prevent the deadly shooting, painting a picture of what they claimed was a negligent mother, more consumed with horses and extramarital affairs than her son's deteriorating mental health. In journal entries shown in court, Ethan wrote, "I have zero help for my mental problems, and it's causing me to shoot up the school. And I want help, but my parents don't listen to me, so I can't get any help." The defense countered that Jennifer was like any other busy mom, and the blame laid elsewhere.
She's not a perfect person or a perfect parent.
Jennifer taking the stand in her own defense, saying before the shooting, she had no reason to believe her son was dangerous.
Of course, I look back after this all happened, and I've asked myself if I would have done anything differently, and I wouldn't have. I wish he would have killed us instead.
Surveillance video played in court shows both Crumblies at the school for a meeting with their son and a counselor after a teacher discovered Ethan's disturbing drawings. That meeting lasting just 11 minutes, no one checking the shooter's backpack for a gun. And within hours, Ethan would open fire at the school. James Crumbly calling 911 when he discovered the handgun he'd bought for Ethan was missing.
I think my son took the gun. I don't know if it's him. I don't know what's going on. I'm really freaking out.
At his trial, James's attorney argued he couldn't have known Ethan was a danger to anyone until it was too late. James and Jennifer nearly emotionless as the judge announced their sentences.
I just can't get over the fact that this tragedy was completely avoidable.
I believe your actions cannot even be confined into the word failure. Your mistakes created our everlasting nightmare.
ABC's Trevor Ault reporting. To Baltimore, where uncertainty and frustration remain weeks after the deadly Francis Scott Key Bridge accident. Crews are hard at work clearing the debris after a container ship struck a support pillar, causing the entire span to collapse, with six construction workers going down with the bridge. Adding to the tragedy, other large ships are stuck, unable to pass through the port of Baltimore because the normal shipping channel is blocked. And as a result, thousands of longshoremen have found themselves with little or no work. ABC's Jay O'Brien talks to some of those whose livelihoods are on hold.
I've seen a lot of incidents that are large, but nothing like this. This is what you would classify as a precedent for the unprecedented. I have never seen a massive bridge close down a port.
Commander Bill McKinstry has managed disasters for the United States Coast Guard for nearly 30 years. But what the people of Baltimore are now facing is a first, even for him.
We're going to go completely around the whole thing.
On the water, the sheer size of the task at hand for McKinstry and others becomes clear. What was once the Francis Scott Key Bridge is now thousands of tons of steel and concrete, blocking most of Baltimore's harbor off from the rest of the world. the mission to cut up and clear all of this debris and bring Baltimore's port back to life is extremely dangerous.
The difficulty that is surrounding that is immense because of the conditions of the water, the divers. You might have a foot of visibility to be able to see. So it makes it very, very treacherous.
Crews now in a race to remove the wreckage, the Army Corps of Engineers setting an ambitious goal of clearing a channel for smaller cargo ships by late April and reopening the entire port by the end of May.
I mean, there are 8,000 jobs tied to this port.
Absolutely. And the bottom line is that's why we need to work as efficiently and as safely as possible. The enormity of the task.
It's going to take a lot of time.
It's going to take some time.
Time is something they don't have at Local 953, one of three unions in Baltimore representing longshoremen. Most of them have already gone weeks without a paycheck and will stay out of work until cargo ships start coming and going again.
These are different ships that were in the Port of Baltimore.
We found Dave Koenig in the dispatch chair fielding calls from longshoremen asking for their next day's assignments, but openings are slim.
All day I tell them I have nothing for them.
You tell them?
I have nothing.
Some are still working on the little cargo that remains in Baltimore from before the bridge collapsed, but that's nothing in comparison to the flurry of activity this port once was.
One, two, three people.
A crisis, says Union President Richard Krueger, a third-generation longshoreman who still makes his living at the port.
You got guys who are going to have to go on unemployment?
Yeah, naturally. You're looking to survive to get through this.
But unemployment, Krueger says, barely covers the steady wages his longshoremen have built their lives with. And he doesn't know how long many of his people can hold out.
It's the fear of the unknown. We don't know how long are they going to be off.
The Port of Baltimore is the ninth largest by trading volume in the country. New cars are one of its biggest imports. And it's Nick Olszewski's job to check the batteries of those cars before they're shipped to dealers across the country. But with no new shipments coming in, soon, he fears, he won't be needed.
So what's going through there now?
Nothing. I know sooner or later it's probably going to affect me that I'll probably get laid off until they get that channel cleared.
We met Nick at Herman's Bakery in Dundalk, Maryland, a neighborhood in what was once the shadow of the Key Bridge. Like so many businesses here, Herman's customers need the port to survive.
He used to sit in the window.
And owner Adrian Porcella needs those customers to keep her business afloat.
I don't know how these people are going to survive. The ones that work at Amazon that live across the bridge where the supply is coming in.
You think it's going to have an effect on your business too?
I really hope not. We're just going to keep working hard. That's all we do. We work hard.
In the back, head baker Larry DeSantis personifies that hard work. He usually arrives here at 1:45 in the morning, commuting not from home, but another bakery job in Baltimore. And for the past 16 years to do that, Larry took the Key Bridge. Larry tells us on that Tuesday morning in late March, he was one of the last people to cross it before the Dolly, a cargo ship the size of the Eiffel Tower, lost power and steering and collided head-on with a pier of that bridge, the ship's size delivering a force comparable to that of a rocket launch.
What was it like seeing that video?
It makes me think, you know, I mean, I'm really lucky.
You're lucky to be alive.
No, exactly. I mean, if I had been 1 minute later, I wouldn't be here.
Eight construction workers, immigrants from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Mexico, were filling potholes on the bridge when it fell. Two were rescued. The bodies of three others have been recovered, and three are still missing, presumed dead. Folks here tell us this is a community that has seen tough times before, but they've always been able to pull through it with hard work. Work here is what makes all the difference. And it's work that's where so many Baltimoreans just want to return.
It's who we are. It's what we do. We load and unload cargo vessels, and we're proud of it. We're stuck in the water here. We can't move.
You're stuck in the water.
Yeah. The truckers, the shippers, the warehouse workers, it's all of us. We're all in the same boat with this.
ABC's Jay O'Brien reporting. Coming up, months after disaster in Maui, ABC News goes from the ruins to a whole other country for an exchange of ideas about how to rise and recover from catastrophe. On Perspective, after this.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. I'm Derek Dennis. Coming up, using comedy to celebrate Arab American heritage and break down stereotypes. But first, it came and went and created quite the buzz. A total solar eclipse sweeping the nation from Texas to Maine, with glimpses of it seen far and wide.
I'm feeling really grateful. And I was a little teary and very excited. And now I just feel, like I said, connected and just really happy.
But what is this phenomenon? What causes it? Why is it visible only once in a while? And if you missed it, when can you see it again? ABC's David Muir breaks down the science.
The Earth rotates on its axis, making a full turn every 24 hours. The moon circles the Earth every 31 days. And the Earth and the Moon rotate around the Sun every 365 days. By cosmic coincidence, the Sun is about 400 times larger than the Moon, and it's also 400 times farther away, making the two appear the same size in our sky from right here on Earth. It's also why the Moon completely covers the Sun when their orbits intersect. A total solar eclipse happens only during a new moon, and when the Moon moves directly between the Earth and the Sun in perfect alignment. The sky will darken as if it were dawn or dusk, and you'll only be able to see the sun's outer atmosphere, the corona. Typically, we don't see it, because 70% of the Earth's surface is water, so it usually happens over our vast oceans or remote areas of other countries. Here in the U.S., we won't see another total solar eclipse for another 20 years.
ABC's David Muir. There were ABC News correspondents all across the path of totality, including Whit Johnson, whose mom, Sharon, has been an eclipse chaser for years. She told her son, no matter how often she sees an eclipse, it's still an awesome experience.
It really puts you in your place in the universe. You realize how small you are, how incredibly beyond our capabilities to even understand that the universe is, and it shines it down on you in this incredible visual experience. And the visuals of it are really a surprise if you've never seen them before. And I recommend to Whit, that's why I made to take him, and anybody else I talk to, is make the effort to see totality if you at all can. It is a remarkable experience in a lifetime.
The next total solar eclipse will happen in August of 2026 over parts of Spain, Iceland, and Portugal. So mark your calendars and start planning your trip. As communities in Maui continue to rebuild after last year's deadly wildfires, its young people are learning about recovery from others thousands of miles away. 11 Lahaina students traveling to northeastern Japan, an area decimated by a tsunami and nuclear disaster in 2011. Their visit, part of a cultural exchange program between Maui and Japan, featuring two communities with the shared pain of a natural disaster. One of the main organizers, Miku Narisawa, opening up to ABC's Becky Worley.
The 11 students are part of a cultural exchange program called Kibo for Maui. Sponsored by Japan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and implemented by the U.S.-Japan Council. The goal, to give these Lahaina teens hope, mana olana in Hawaiian, kibo, in Japanese.
I was born and raised in
the driving force behind this trip is Miku Narisawa. She's co-founder of Odyssey Nature Japan.
When I saw the wildfires, then I immediately said, okay, this is something that we should do for the kids in Lahaina.
What do you hope that they realize from seeing you 13 years on, seeing this place 13 years on?
I want them to know that experience the wildfire was really tough, I'm sure. But that is not the end of the world, and that's not the end of everything.
Miku herself benefited from a similar program called Tomodachi Rainbow for Japan Kids. And after the tsunami, she traveled to Hawaii with 150 other Japanese students.
This is a full circle for us.
Hawaii resident and USJC board member Yo Kawanami was a volunteer and met Miku in 2011.
I met this 13-year-old that had lost a lot at that time, and fast forward to 13 years later, she is a co-founder to a nonprofit organization in Tohoku area where she is preaching sustainability, growth, and giving back to the community. When you have a role model that actually has walked the talk, she is a survivor, and now she's a leader. Nothing should stop the 11 students, the Maui students, to feel the same. Having Miku in front of that is a true example of what hope could be for these students.
One of those kids, Zine Lagpakan, who lost his home in the fire. Back on Maui, it's the night before the trip, and the nerves are running high.
What's your worry for a rebuilt Lahaina?
Oh, I worry that there's going to be no housing for the residents before the fire. I feel like a lot of situations where this happens, it turns into a big tourist trap, and I just don't want that to happen to my hometown.
Yeah. What do you hope that you can learn in Japan to keep that from happening?
I'm not entirely sure, actually. That's the reason why I'm going to Japan. I want to ask them how to make it feel like home again.
A few miles away, Mia Kosanowski, hoping the trip brings her clarity.
I just want to help any way I can because I love this community so much.
All of the students are hoping to contribute, like MG, a high school senior who's already taking college-level courses in disaster management.
I started taking course this semester and I've loved it. It relies on human history and human error to improve the system.
On arrival, the students taking it all in.
Oh, wow.
The students getting a glimpse of what was left after the disaster here, a time capsule of what this town once was.
It kind of gives us hope for Lahaina because they were talking about how everything was underwater and like seeing home, like just everything's burnt right now to see like there is hope, like it can come back and flourish and like have life again.
Seeing how high the wave of water was, now just a line of paint on the wall. Hearing stories of survival and loss, it struck a chord with Zine.
That really hit me hard.
There were so many parallels with Lahaina in the story of the tsunami. What did you see that was the same?
I guess the sentimentality about how people lost their loved ones, and I could really relate.
But the magic of this trip, the kids realizing there is life even after a disaster of this magnitude, and that their lives will not always be dominated by the fire. They meet Japanese students bonding over sports and their favorite foods. They share culture and also learn how this community found healing.
My hope is that they return home and, you know, they use what they've learned from Japan and everyone that they met here and put it into action back home.
The week culminating with those ideas.
So that brings the question, what can we bring back to Lahaina?
So when I visited Onagawa, I found it very interesting on how they decided to rebuild. This made me realize that we need to think strategically when it comes to rebuilding our hometown.
We also want to bring back hope. Hope in meaning like we can rebuild and recover Lahaina back. This trip really gave me hope, and I thought if I got a spark of hope, I think my community will also will.
ABC's Becky Worley reporting. Coming up, the coronavirus pandemic far from over for one young boy struggling with long COVID. His story in his own words on Perspective after this. You're listening to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. April is Arab American Heritage Month, and some are using comedy to break down negative stereotypes. ABC News talked to two comedians, Iman Morgan and Maysoon Zaid, looking to change the way their culture is perceived.
And the United States government will not let his mother visit because they claim she's on the terror watch list. Because I put her there.
The New York Arab American Comedy Festival was founded by me and Dean Obidala in the wake of 9/11 and also the run-up to the Iraq War. We were being vilified, not just in the media, but in the mainstream population. So we thought about doing the comedy festival to kind of combat those negative images of Arabs in media, but also to remind Hollywood that we were the OGs of comedy. Some of the founders of comedy in Hollywood are Arab. People like Danny Thomas, Marlo Thomas, you know, Vic Tayback, Jamie Farr, Tony Shalhoub. So we kind of wanted to stop being belly dancers and taxi drivers and terrorists and burqa wearers and get back to being all in the family.
Yo, you Dominican or you Puerto Rican? I'm like, actually, I'm Egyptian. But no. I'm like, trust me, no one's lying claiming they're Middle Eastern.
Egyptians have a sense of humor. They were born with it. It's like it's in their DNA. You can't go to Egypt right now without walking down the street without hearing somebody laugh or telling a joke every second. So I like to kind of bring it here.
I'm using the language of comedy not to humanize myself. I refuse to attempt to humanize myself. If you don't think I'm a human, making you laugh while you drink is not gonna make me human. But my job is to make people laugh first and foremost. And if while they're laughing, they learn something they didn't know or they stop fearing something they've always feared, then that's like the cherry on top.
Comedians Maysoon Zaid and Iman Morgan. National Library Week is a time meant to encourage people to read and to highlight the importance of libraries around the world. It's also a big moment for a literary giant. Stephen King, the author of bone-chilling horror novels like Salem's Lot, Pet Sematary, and The Shining, is marking 50 years since the debut of his first horror novel, Carrie. ABC's Mike Dubusky nearly scared himself to death for a look back at half a century of Stephen King.
Whether it's the axe going through the door,
here's Johnny,
a red balloon drifting up from a sewer grate,
I, Georgie, am Pennywise the Dancing Clown.
It's not a monster, it's just a doggy.
Or a rabid dog trapping a mother and child in their car. There's a good chance you're familiar with at least one of the terrifying images that Stephen King has burned into our collective consciousness over the last five decades. His published work, numbering dozens of novels, hundreds of short stories, plus nonfiction, even poetry, has cemented King as one of the world's most successful writers. But it wasn't always that way.
Horror had been dismissed as kids' stuff, you know, like crusty old dusty vampire things for children.
Grady Hendrix is a horror writer himself, the author of books like My Best Friend's Exorcism and How to Sell a Haunted House. Hendrix says after the 1930s, horror fiction saw a decades-long slump. It was only during the late 60s and early 70s that a few books broke through to adult audiences.
In 67, Rosemary's Baby came out, and that became a huge hit and then a hit movie. Right after that, there was a book by Thomas Tryon called The Other. And right after that, in 71, you had William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist, which is a huge hit as a book. And in 73, it became a huge cultural moment when it came out as a movie.
When she started talking like devil coming out of her, bleh.
That was the stage onto which Carrie arrived in 1974. Stephen King's first published novel tells the tale of Carrie White, a high school girl terrorized by bullies and tortured by her ultra-religious mother. Oh, and there's another thing you should know about Carrie.
She also has telekinetic powers that are just coming into bloom as she enters puberty. And as students lash out and bully her, she strikes back, and it all culminates on prom when she kills everyone with her mind.
In Carrie's defense, those bullies did dump a bucket of pig's blood on her first. And that's all before the book was adapted into a hit movie starring Sissy Spacek in 1976. There are a lot of Stephen King adaptations. In fact, over 50 movies have been made based on his work, nearly 30 television series. But no discussion of King adaptations is complete without a visit to the Overlook Hotel.
Come play with us, Daddy.
The Shining is the story of Jack Torrance, a recovering alcoholic who takes a job as the caretaker of a remote hotel in the Colorado Rockies. But in classic King fashion, the hotel is haunted, Jack's son Danny is clairvoyant, and Jack himself is driven to madness and eventually tries to kill his family, hence the axe through the door.
And that was really where King was early in his career. He was a high school English teacher. He was dead broke. He was really worried the writing was never going to work out. He had lots of books that were rejected, and he had a drinking problem and was really worried that he was going to wreck his family.
The Shining, published just a few years after Carrie, was picked up by one of the biggest names in movie making, Stanley Kubrick, and adapted into a movie starring Jack Nicholson in 1980. But despite being considered one of the greatest horror movies of all time, King isn't a fan of Kubrick's take on The Shining.
With Kubrick's The Shining, I felt that it was very cold.
I think it's so close to him and so came from such a personal place, he just cannot get or appreciate that someone is doing something else with that book.
King's personal life often bleeds through into his work, says Hendricks. Long after the drug and alcohol abuse of King's early career, he was involved in a serious car accident in 1999. He was hit by a van along the side of the road near his home in Maine while he was writing the book Duma Key,
which is a book about a guy who's in a terrible car accident, loses his arm, loses his family because of a lot of the side effects of the accident, and winds up going off to heal and get in touch with his art, which is painting. And then, of course, there's ghosts and supernatural things that come in after that.
Hendrick says that's a big part of why King's work and horror in general is so resonant with so many.
Horror is often set in the everyday world. It's set in the here and now. It features regular people, but with more interesting stuff in it, like vampires and killer dogs and haunted hotels.
Or, as Stephen King himself told David Letterman back in 1980,
if you're being scared out of your wits when the scare ends, when the lights go up, or when the book ends, you know, you say to yourself, I thought things were bad for me, but at least I'm not in that position.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike DeBusky, ABC News.
Before we go, for many, the coronavirus pandemic is a not-so-distant memory. The lockdowns, the isolation, the masking, the sickness. And unfortunately, for 7 million victims worldwide, even death. And then there's the lingering symptoms of the disease, defined as long COVID, causing suffering weeks, months, and in some cases, years after infection. 12-year-old Theo Huat de St. Alban says he's been suffering a four-year battle with long COVID, calling it an invisible disease. He was just 9 years old when he first contracted the coronavirus in 2020, which means he spent a third of his young life battling COVID on and off.
It's very unpredictable. It goes in waves, but it's always there. There's no real way to tell how I'm going to feel.
He says his symptoms of long COVID have been worse than his actual COVID infection because the symptoms of his active infection were constant. In his experience, the symptoms of long COVID have been sporadic. They come and go with no warning and no timetable. His symptoms? Brain fog, fatigue, migraines, and muscle pain taking over his young body. The CDC is still studying the effects of long COVID, so there's not much data available yet. Researchers say there's no one test to diagnose long COVID, primarily because it typically manifests as several different symptoms or illnesses rather than a single one. Theo wants others to know COVID is not gone. It can and does linger long term. Managing it is tough, but possible. Theo is living proof. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. This show is produced by Aaron Ferrer, Marwa Muwaki, and Joy Piazza. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review. If you've got the time, tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Derek Dennis.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.